Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at theopenhouse.net.au blog site.
Well, when was the last time you were applauded for slowing down? When was the last time that you were congratulated for doing things really slowly? Doesn't seem to be anything we're particularly familiar with in our society. If anything, we're applauded for speeding things up, becoming more efficient, achieving more with less and less time. Well, our next guest is kind of questioning all that. His name is Carl Honoré, and he's written extensively on the slow movement, basically the idea that life is better when it's slower. And he's also applied his philosophy to parenting. He's actually warning parents away from hyper-scheduling their children's lives. He joins us on Open House now. Carl, welcome to Open House.
Thanks. It's good to be with you.
Why don't we get on to the latest book, which is called Under Pressure, which is where you apply this living slow idea to parenting and to children. But let's go back to the first book, In Praise of Slow, where you outlined the slow movement. Describe it. What is it?
Well, the slow movement is a kind of global backlash against the dominant mainstream culture, which tells us that faster is always better. And it seems that certainly in the last generation, we've wound ourselves up into this roadrunner culture where we're always trying to do more and more in less time. And I think it's backfiring us in every sense. It's taking a toll on our health, our diets, our relationships, the quality of our work, our communities, and the environment. And that's why wherever you go now around the world, people are starting to say, you know what? Faster isn't always better. And they're looking for ways to put on the brakes, not to do everything slowly, because that would be dreadful. I can't think of anything worse than a world where everything had to be slow. But I guess this slow philosophy, in essence, is really about doing things at the right speed. So there are times to be fast, but there are times to slow down as well. It's about reconnecting with your inner tortoise, if you like, and trying to do things as well as possible instead of trying to do them always as fast as possible.
Yeah, well, I think it's the age-old phrase of "Does the fish know it's wet?" Give me some examples as to how we're hyper pacing ourselves.
Well, I think that even things that are by their very nature slow, we are trying to accelerate. Now, I live in London, in England, and there's a gym near my house that runs an evening class in speed yoga. So this is for time-starved professionals. Or there's another example in the United States. A friend of mine was recently invited to a drive-through funeral where they put the coffin outside the church and people pull up in a car, roll down a window, throw a flower, and drive off. And on average, this is for real, on average, someone did a study recently, on average people spend 90 seconds beside the coffin. And you think about that for a moment. I mean, 90 seconds to say farewell to a loved one, it's perverse, but this is the world that we've backed ourselves into now, always trying to do things more and more quickly. And I think it's taking a real toll on everything we do.
I'm just musing now, but I'd imagine that probably it has something to do with the Industrial Revolution, where we were able to manufacture more and more things at less cost. Is that the driving force behind this hyper pace of our society?
I think it's one of the forces pushing this along. But in fact, I think in some ways the technology and the Industrial Revolution, these things are symptoms in some ways as much as causes. I think that really the deepest cause is our very neurotic and dysfunctional relationship with time itself. In the Western world, we see time as linear. We think of it as a natural, you know, limited resource that's always running away from us. And it turns, I think, every moment into a race against the clock. You know, that phrase, time is money, that seems to define every moment of our day, is actually a phrase from 250 years ago from Benjamin Franklin. And I think when you take that very unhealthy view of time, that time is the enemy, you've got to take it by the scruff of the neck and shake it for everything it's worth, that infects everything you do. And I think that, in some ways, could be argued as one of the driving forces of the Industrial Revolution. You know, we sought out this technology that, you know, even today, this software and high-tech goodies that allow us to do everything at the push of a button, we sought those things out because we had this crazy, unhealthy relationship with time rather than the other way around. But I think that there's probably a self-fulfilling loop and the things feed back into each other.
So where did the slow movement originate? Can you put your finger on any place or any particular moment?
Well, I think there's always been a counter current for slowness in our culture in the West. Even the hippies, you know, and then the 60s talking about tuning out and dropping out and mellowing out and so on. But I think that what we think of as the modern slow movement probably certainly got its name from slow food, which began in Italy as a reaction against the arrival of McDonald's on the Spanish steps in Rome. And that was in the late 80s and early 90s. And slow food has now spread right across the world and has over 80,000 members in 50-something countries, including Australia. And slow food is based on a very simple and sensible idea, which is that we get a lot of more nutrition, pleasure, and social connection from our food when what we eat is cultivated, cooked, and consumed at a more reasonable pace. And slow food, I think, did something very important, which was to reclaim the word slow, which had become a four-letter word in Western culture, a dirty word. And it said, we're taking slow back and saying that slow is a good thing. And, mm. and you know, now you see that the English word slow has spread right out across the world, and people hang it on everything. There are slow architecture, slow design, slow work, slow travel, slow parenting. Whatever you can think of doing, you can hang the word slow on it as shorthand for a better, more balanced way of doing whatever it is you're doing.
Mm, well, we've got enough stomach ulcers. Something's got to be done, that's for sure.
Yeah.
This is Open House right across Australia. We're talking to Carl Honoré. He's written this book called Under Pressure, which follows on from another one called In Praise of Slow, talking about the slow movement and particularly how it relates to parenting. So, Carl, let's move on to that then. The whole idea of hyper-parenting is a phrase that you use. Tell me mm-hmm. about that. What is the phenomenon then?
Well, hyper-parenting I think of as good parenting run amok. So this starts in a very natural and noble place, which is the instinct that all of us have as parents, and I'm the father of two children, 9 and 6, so I know this well, that the instinct to do the best by our kids. But the problem is that over the last generation, that impulse has morphed into something exaggerated and extreme, so that as parents, we feel under pressure to push, polish, and protect our kids with superhuman zeal. We feel we have to give them the best of everything and at the same time make them the best at everything. And there's this strange notion out there among parents that it's all or nothing nowadays, that only an alpha child will survive, that your kid has two options in life. One, he's in Mensa at 9, he's a Rhodes Scholar at 17, and he's on the front cover of Time magazine at 25. Or option two, he's sleeping rough under a bridge. Of course, that's preposterous, but in some ways, that's the way it feels for parents on the front line, that it's all or nothing. And I think that in essence, is what hyperparenting is. It starts from a good place, but it's got out of control.
Parents wanting their child to become the next Tiger Woods or the next world leader or the next Hollywood actor or whatever it might be. And then the frantic schedule that seems to be a part of children's lives these days is, you know, there's sport and there's acting lessons and there's tuition after school. And there's so many things. It does seem to have just spiraled out of control.
It has, really, over the last generation. There's been a quantum shift. I mean, the tectonic plates have moved in an extraordinary way below the surface in the last, I'd say, 15 years. And it is remarkable. And I had this experience myself. I mean, the reason I wrote this book was that I found myself, you know, even me as a spokesman for the slow movement, I found myself falling into the same trap when I was at a parent-teacher evening. And I went along to the art room, and my son loves to draw, but I got to the art room, and the art teacher was just falling over herself and said, your son is wonderful, he's creative, he's imaginative. Look, here on the wall we've hung up one of his drawings as a model for other pupils. And I was thinking, well, this is great. and then she dropped what I think of as the G-bomb, and she said, your son is gifted. And suddenly it was like I couldn't hear anything else. You know, I went straight home, and instead of just being happy that my son was that he clearly was very good at drawing and took a great deal of pleasure from it, I began to imagine I was raising the next Picasso. So what did I do as a 21st century parent? I started on Google looking for a tutor or an art clinic or an art summer camp. Mm-hmm. And I said to him the next morning, I said, here, I found this tutor. What do you think? Thankfully, he said no. He said, no, I just want to draw. What's wrong with that? And mm-hmm. then he delivered what I think of as the coup de grace. He said, you know, why do grown-ups always have to take over everything? And it was one of those awful moments of searing epiphany, you know, when a 7-year-old says something like that to you and you suddenly see yourself in sharp relief. And I thought, whoa, you know, he's right. I am trying to take over. I'm becoming one of those pushy parents you read about in the Sunday newspapers. Yeah, yeah. And it's so easy. It's so easy for that good parenting instinct to slip into something over the top. And I guess that's what the book is really about, is not just parents, because, of course, parents are part of a bigger picture here. I'm looking in the book at how advertisers are part of this hijacking of childhood, how officialdom, with the way schooling systems have changed and safety regulations banning high-risk activities like snowball fights, you know, from school playgrounds. So it's part of a bigger cultural shift, but, of course, parents are on the front line.
Yeah, well, let's talk a little bit about some of those cultural shifts and, the forces behind hyper-parenting, because, yeah, I just think about some of the things that I used to do when I was at school. Some of the things that now seem to be outlawed. What are those kinds of things? Give us a bit of a rundown as to the kinds of things that maybe you and I as children used to be able to do that our kids today can't do.
Well, very simple. I've just come back from North America, and there's a huge controversy raging over a school in Virginia near Washington, D.C., which has outlawed tag. And they decided that tag was a high-risk, dangerous activity, and that children were getting too worked up, and so occasionally were falling over and scraping a knee. So they banned it. And this seems to be the reflex now, is that anything, we almost want to create this perfect childhood where nothing bad happens, where children never feel bad, where they never scrape a knee or you know, sprain an ankle or break an arm. And, of course, you can understand the impulse there. You know, we love our children and we want the best for them. But, but the problem is when that goes so far, you children need risk. They need to scrape their knee from time to time because that's how they learn how to cope with adversity and learn how to get on with their friends and
But Carl, what is driving that, though? That's what fascinates me. What is driving this cocooning of children, this continual pursuit for the perfection, the perfect child and everything? We've got a commentator here in Australia called Hugh McKay. We were talking to him late last year. He was saying something very similar about marriage. We're pursuing the perfect marriage, and therefore, of course, the person we're married to is not measuring up at all. Why are we doing it?
I think that we're living through what I think of as a kind of cultural perfect storm where various trends have come together at the same time. And the first is that we have created a culture of perfection. And I think the consumerist juggernaut was a big part of that because we're bombarded with the message that we ought to aspire to the perfect kitchen, the perfect vacation, perfect teeth, a perfect body, perfect relationship, and a perfect child just rounds out the image. And I think that's something that underlies a lot of how we approach our relationships now, is that we want everything to be the perfect Kodak moment. And it becomes stultifying, but we still cling to it. I think that there are other shifts have gone on here as well that have changed, particularly the parenting landscape. And one of those is the workplace is more competitive now, and there is more uncertainty in the labor market. And I think that drives parents to push and polish to create an extra competitive edge for the kids. But there's another change, which I think is maybe in some ways the most important, and that is the demographic shift we've seen over the last generation. On one hand, we have smaller families for the most part in the middle classes. So just by simple arithmetic, you have more time to plow into each individual child. Mm. So that's one thing. But also, we're having children older, and that makes a big difference, particularly for women. If you think of a woman having her first child at 20 versus a woman having her first child at 39 and a half, you know, there's a big difference there in mindset. And the 39-and-a-half-year-old is probably thinking, and maybe she spent a lot of money, you know, and whatever it is to help get, thinking, phew, you know, I've just skidded in at the deadline here. I've got one kid, maybe I've got to make the most of it. So there's an anxiety built in there to be the perfect parent, I think, to start with. And then lastly, because both as fathers and mothers we come to family life older, it means we spent many more years in the workplace. And what that leads to is an importing of this best practice office ethos. So we think, how do we parent better? Well, we'll do what we do at work. Bring in the experts, we'll spend a lot of money, and we'll put in long, hard hours at it. You know, we will professionalize parenting as we've professionalized almost everything else, whether it's the search for a partner or, you know, the way we tend our gardens. Everything has been kind of professionalized in a way. So I think when you bring all of that stuff together at the same time, you end up with this peculiar pressure cooker approach to children and child rearing.
We're talking to Carl Onore. He's the author of this book, Under Pressure, talking about the hyper-parenting that seems to be so prevalent amongst our society. And of course, it's all connected with this idea to live life as fast as we possibly can. Fascinating. We're carrying the podcast via theopenhouse.net.au as well. Okay, Carl, well, we need to talk about the effects on the kids then. What do you think are going to be the effects on the kids, both as young kids, but also when they grow up?
Well, we're already seeing it, and you would think, with all the time, money, and energy we're plowing into our children, that we would be seeing now the emergence of the happiest, healthiest, most intelligent and creative kids the world has ever seen. But let's be honest, that's not what's happening out there. You look at obesity rates skyrocketing among the young. You see sports injuries more common in children than ever before. You see the number of kids who are on medication to control their mood or behavior higher than ever before. And child depression and anxiety and the suicide, substance abuse, and self-harm that often go along with them are now most common, not in the urban ghettos where families are struggling to make ends meet, but in the smart downtown flats and the leafy suburbs where the project-managing middle classes are piling on the pressure onto their kids, are treating parenting as product development. And we're starting to see now the first spearhead of this generation of kids coming through. And they've been so micromanaged. Every moment of their childhood has been structured, supervised, monitored, measured, that when they come up the other end, they struggle to stand on their own two feet. So you hear now from professors in universities around the world who say they find themselves in tutorials with 19-year-olds who have glittering CVs and look incredible on paper, but get frustrated and flustered. And when they don't know how to deal with an argument, they whip out the mobile phone, they hit speed dial, they hand over the phone to the professor, and they say, sort this out with my mom. And the umbilical cord remains intact so much now that kids are going to job interviews with their parents. So you get mom and dad turning up to help negotiate salary and vacation packages at companies, even issuing what they call parent packs or holding parent open days where mom and dad can come and inspect the office to make sure it's okay for junior.
No way.
No, I mean, it's breathtaking. It's extraordinary. But this is the beginning now, because we are seeing, I think, this whole hyper-parenting or helicopter parenting, whatever you call it, has really come into its own probably since the late 80s, early 90s. So it's the first generation coming through now, and they're really struggling. And that's why you're seeing a whole generation of 20-somethings going back home to live. Some of that is grotesquely inflated property prices and student debt. There's no doubt that that's part of the equation, too. But part of it also is that they have been the center of the parental universe for their whole childhood. You know, they turn up at a job and they expect to be on the board 6 months later, but that's not the way the real world works. So a lot of them just end up going home.
Well, we've talked about the effect of hyperparenting on the child. What's the effect of hyperparenting on parents?
Well, I think it does harm to parents as well, because we end up becoming overinvested in our children, and that does a number of things. The first is that it just erodes a lot of the time that the mother and father have with themselves, and you end up kind of living through your children, and you find yourself going out to dinner and you have nothing to talk about apart from your children. This goes beyond just the couple itself. I think I find this a lot. You go to barbecues or drinks parties or whatever in the neighborhood, and the parents are all there, and the only thing a lot of them can talk about is their own children. You know, and sometimes you find parents talking about their kids in the collective pronoun. You know, we have a lot of homework this weekend, or we're applying to Oxford, or we're signing up for football. And you think, you know, it's not we, it's Johnny, your son, or Susie, your daughter. And I think that we lose a lot of the joy, simple joy of being a child, and the simple joy of being a parent gets crowded out when child rearing becomes product development or a rat race. I mean, parenting is always going to be hard work. It's not just a bed of roses. But if you don't have that equilibrium where there are times when you're down there in the trenches and it's tough and it's hard, that's fine. But there should also be times when you can ease off and you can just enjoy, you can go with the flow. And I think that when we lose that, we lose something really basic and really human, which is the pleasure of being a mother or a father.
All right, Carl. Well, you have thousands of parents listening right now, and at least a good percentage of them are kind of going, all right, maybe I need to do something. What would you say? How do you counsel the parent who says, all right, I admit it, our individual schedules are full and we're doing that to our child? How do you even begin to wind down, to decelerate?
I think a first step for most families now is, and it sounds like a paradox, but in this hyper-scheduled culture, I think we've reached the stage where we almost need to schedule unscheduled time. So I think a good starting point for a very, very busy family is to think about setting aside maybe just to start an hour a day when the child or the children are left to their own devices. So they have parent or adult free time. And that doesn't include farming them out to the PlayStation or the computer. I think the gadgets should be switched off and just be left to themselves to play, just simple play, to work out, to think, to read, to relax, to play with their friends. I think that's a very important thing, is to have some adult free time ring fenced off every day. I think it's also important, you know, with extracurriculars, which are wonderful things. I'm not against extracurricular activities. I think they can be great. I just think a lot of kids are getting too much of a good thing. But maybe as a parent, you know, nowadays we go along and we stay there. We're on the sidelines. We're shouting at the referee. You know, maybe with one of your children's extracurriculars, you just, next time, you drop them off and you leave. You know, you just leave them there and come back an hour and a half later and pick them up. Just to give that space,
bit of space,
both to the child and to yourself, just to create that distance so that it's clear to everyone that this is about the child rather than about the parents. You know, maybe the next time don't stay, but the time after, stay. You know, try and find a balance there to relearn that art of stepping back. I think another thing for parents to think about is maybe try go a week without consulting a parenting manual or magazine or website, just to take a breather from the avalanche of advice that I think often ends up eroding our confidence as parents rather than building it up, because so much of the advice is contradictory. It distracts us, and it also takes us away from that inner voice that we all have, because at the end of the day, we as parents know our children better than anyone else, and we know ourselves better than anyone else, and we know the dynamic of our family better than anyone else. And I think a lot of what reclaiming this balance in our lives is about shutting out the sound and fury that surrounds so much of modern childhood and just listen and try and work out what makes sense more for your family. Is it one extracurricular per child? Is it two? Is it, you know, there's so many different ways to parent, and it's about getting away from this idea that there's a single recipe, a perfect recipe, that there are many different styles, and to try and find that style. And lastly, I would suggest to parents, and this is something I find useful often, just to put my feet back on the ground when I lose my head from time to time, it's just to look around at the people in my social circle that I like and admire, and think about how they grew up. I mean, what kind of childhoods they had. My guess is that most of those people were not Rhodes Scholars or valedictorians, that they weren't labeled as gifted in their childhood, and that many of them were probably late bloomers, you know, that they came to adulthood through very many different paths. And I think that's very important to hold on to as a parent, to remember that every child is different, every child has different strengths and weaknesses, and that there's so many different ways to grow up, and that it is not all or nothing. Yeah. That's the most important thing. It is not all or nothing, and that it's okay to relax a bit, you know, because it will be okay, because it almost always is. And I think that's something to hang on to in this crazy fast-forward world where we lose sight often of the texture and detail and variety that there is in the human condition. We just get caught up in this idea that it's one thing or the other, and it's not.
Well, here's in praise of watching flowers grow and leaves fall and scribbling in the sand. That's what I say.
Yeah, I mean, it's the William Blake idea of seeing a world in a grain of sand and holding infinity in the palm of your hand. I think that gentle poetry sums up a lot about the soaring magic and majesty of childhood. And I think we need to create some space for that again. Yeah. Otherwise, we're losing out.
Yeah, Carl, very important to talk to you, and it's been a pleasure. Thanks for your time.
Thank you very much.
Carl Honore there, the author of In Praise of Slow, and this new book, Under Pressure, all about hyper-parenting, published through Allen & Unwin.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. To hear more from Open House, visit theopenhouse.net.au.